Pocket Full of Rye, A Miss Marple Mystery, by Agatha Christie, narrated by Rosalind Ayers.
Chapter 1. It was Miss Summers' turn to make the tea. Miss Summers was the newest and the most inefficient of the typists. She was no longer young, and had a mild, worried face, like a sheep. The kettle was not quite boiling when Miss Summers poured the water onto the tea, but poor Miss Summers was never quite sure when a kettle was boiling. It was one of the many worries that afflicted her in life. She poured out the tea and took the cups round with a couple of limp, sweet biscuits in each saucer. Miss Griffith, the efficient head typist, a grey-haired martinet who had been with Consolidated Investments Trust for 16 years, said sharply, "Water not boiling again, Summers!" And Miss Summers' worried, meek face went pink, and she said, "Oh, dear, I did think it was boiling this time." Miss Griffith thought to herself, "She'll last for another month, perhaps, just while we're so busy. But really, the mess the silly idiot made of that letter to Eastern Developments. A perfectly straightforward job, and always so stupid over the tea. If it weren't so difficult to get hold of any intelligent typists. And the biscuit tin lid wasn't shut tightly last time, either. Really..." Like so many of Miss Griffith's indignant inner communings, the sentence went unfinished. At that moment, Miss Grosvenor sailed in to make Mr. Fortescue's sacred tea. Mr. Fortescue had different tea and different china and special biscuits. Only the kettle and the water from the cloakroom tap were the same. But on this occasion, being Mr. Fortescue's tea, the water boiled. Miss Grosvenor saw to that. Miss Grosvenor was an incredibly glamorous blonde. She wore an expensively cut little black suit, and her shapely legs were encased in the very best and most expensive black market nylons. She sailed back through the typist's room without deigning to give anyone a word or a glance. The typists might have been so many black beetles. Miss Grosvenor was Mr. Fortescue's own special personal secretary. Unkind rumour always hinted that she was something more, but actually this was not true. Mr. Fortescue had recently married a second wife, both glamorous and expensive, and fully capable of absorbing all his attention. Miss Grosvenor was, to Mr. Fortescue, just a necessary part of the office decor, which was all very luxurious and very expensive. Miss Grosvenor sailed back, with the tray held out in front of her, like a ritual offering, through the inner office and through the waiting room, where the more important clients were allowed to sit, and through her own anteroom, and finally, with a light tap on the door, she entered that holy of holies, Mr. Fortescue's office. It was a large room, with a gleaming expanse of parquet floor, on which were dotted expensive oriental rugs. It was delicately panelled in pale wood, and there were some enormous stuffed chairs, upholstered in pale buff leather. Behind a colossal sycamore desk, the centre and focus of the room, sat Mr. Fortescue himself. Mr. Fortescue was less impressive than he should have been to match the room, but he did his best. He was a large, flabby man with a gleaming bald head. It was his affectation to wear loosely cut country tweed in his city office. He was frowning down at some papers on his desk when Miss Grosvenor glided up to him in her swan-like manner. Placing the tray on the desk at his elbow, she murmured in a low, impersonal voice, "Your tea, Mr. Fortescue," and withdrew. Mr. Fortescue's contribution to the ritual was a grunt. Seated at her own desk again, Miss Grosvenor proceeded with the business in hand. She made 2 telephone calls, corrected some letters that were lying there, typed, ready for Mr. Fortescue to sign, and took 1 incoming call. "I'm afraid it's impossible just now," she said in haughty accents. "Mr. Fortescue is in conference." As she laid down the receiver, she glanced at the clock. It was 11:10. It was just then that an unusual sound penetrated through the almost soundproof door of Mr. Fortescue's office. Muffled, it was yet fully recognizable. A strangled, agonized cry. At the same moment, the buzzer on Miss Grosvenor's desk sounded in a long-drawn, frenzied summons. Miss Grosvenor, startled for a moment into complete immobility, rose uncertainly to her feet. Confronted by the unexpected, her poise was shaken. However, she moved towards Mr. Fortescue's door in her usual statuesque fashion, tapped, and entered. What she saw upset her poise still further. Her employer behind his desk seemed contorted with agony. His convulsive movements were alarming to watch. Miss Grosvenor said, "Oh, dear, Mr. Fortescue, are you ill?" and was immediately conscious of the idiocy of the question. There was no doubt that Mr. Fortescue was very seriously ill. Even as she came up to him, his body was convulsed in a painful, spasmodic movement. Words came out in jerky gasps.
"Tea! What the hell? You put in the tea! Get help! Quick! Get a doctor!"
Miss Grosvenor fled from the room. She was no longer the supercilious blonde secretary. She was a thoroughly frightened woman who had lost her head. She came running into the typist's office, crying out, "Mr. Fortescue's having a fit! He's dying! We must get a doctor! He looks awful! I'm sure he's dying!" Reactions were immediate and varied a good deal. Miss Bell, the youngest typist, said, "If it's epilepsy, we ought to put a cork in his mouth. Who's got a cork?" Nobody had a cork. Miss Summers said, "At his age, it's probably apoplexy." Miss Griffith said, "We must get a doctor at once." But she was hampered in her usual efficiency, because in all her 16 years of service, it had never been necessary to call a doctor to the city office. There was her own doctor, but that was at Streatham Hill. Where was there a doctor near here? Nobody knew. Miss Bell seized a telephone directory and began looking up doctors under D. But it was not a classified directory, and doctors were not automatically listed, like taxis. Someone suggested a hospital. But which hospital?
"It has to be the right hospital," Miss Summers insisted, "or else they won't come, because of the national health, I mean. It's got to be in the area."
Someone suggested that she dial emergency at 999, but Miss Griffith was shocked at that and said it would mean the police, and that would never do. For citizens of a country which enjoyed the benefits of a medical service for all, a group of quite reasonably intelligent women showed incredible ignorance of correct procedure. Miss Bell started looking up ambulances under A. Miss Griffith said, "There's his own doctor. He must have a doctor." Someone rushed for the private address book. Miss Griffith instructed the office boy to go out and find a doctor, somehow, anywhere. In the private address book, Miss Griffith found Sir Edwin Sandeman, with an address in Harley Street. Miss Grosvenor, collapsed in a chair, wailed in a voice whose accent was noticeably less Mayfair than usual,
"I made the tea just as usual, really I did. There couldn't have been anything wrong in it."
"Wrong in it?" Miss Griffith paused, her hand on the dial of the telephone.
"Why do you say that?" "He said it, Mr. Fortescue. He said it was the tea."
Miss Griffith's hand hovered irresolutely between Welbeck and 999. Miss Bell, young and hopeful, said,
"We ought to give him some mustard and water, now. Isn't there any mustard in the office?"
There was no mustard in the office. Some short while later, Dr. Isaacs of Bethnal Green and Sir Edwin Sandeman met in the elevator, just as two different ambulances drew up in front of the building. The telephone and the office boy had done their work. Chapter 2. Inspector Neil sat in Mr. Fortescue's sanctum, behind Mr. Fortescue's vast sycamore desk. One of his underlings with a notebook sat unobtrusively against the wall near the door. Inspector Neil had a smart, soldierly appearance, with crisp brown hair growing back from a rather low forehead. When he uttered the phrase, "Just a matter of routine," those addressed were wont to think spitefully, "And routine is about all you're capable of." They would have been quite wrong. Behind his unimaginative appearance, Inspector Neil was a highly imaginative thinker, and one of his methods of investigation was to propound to himself fantastic theories of guilt which he applied to such persons as he was interrogating at the time. Miss Griffith, whom he had at once picked out with an unerring eye as being the most suitable person to give him a succinct account of the events which had led to his being seated where he was, had just left the room, having given him an admirable resume of the morning's happenings. Inspector Neil propounded to himself three separate, highly coloured reasons why the faithful doyenne of the typist's room should have poisoned her employer's mid-morning cup of tea, and rejected them as unlikely. He classified Miss Griffith as A, not the type of a poisoner, B, not in love with her employer, C, no pronounced mental instability, D, not a woman who cherished grudges. That really seemed to dispose of Miss Griffith, except as a source of accurate information. Inspector Neil glanced at the telephone. He was expecting a call from St. Jude's Hospital at any moment now. It was possible, of course, that Mr. Fortescue's sudden illness was due to natural causes, but Dr. Isaacs of Bethnal Green had not thought so, and Sir Edwin Sanderman of Harley Street had not thought so. Inspector Neil pressed a buzzer, conveniently situated at his left hand, and demanded that Mr. Fortescue's personal secretary should be sent in to him. Miss Grosvenor had recovered a little of her poise, but not much. She came in apprehensively, with nothing of the swan-like glide about her motions, and said at once, defensively, "I didn't do it." Inspector Neil murmured conversationally, "No." He indicated the chair where Miss Grosvenor was wont to place herself, pad in hand, when summoned to take down Mr. Fortescue's letters. She sat down now with reluctance, and eyed Inspector Neil in alarm. Inspector Neil, his mind playing imaginatively on the themes seduction, blackmail, platinum, blonde in court, etc., looked reassuring and just a little stupid. "There wasn't anything wrong with the tea," said Miss Grosvenor. "There couldn't have been."
"I see," said Inspector Neil. "Your name and address, please?"
"Grosvenor. Irene Grosvenor."
"How do you spell it?"
"Oh, like the square."
"And your address?"
14 Rushmore Road, Muswell Hill."
Inspector Neil nodded in satisfied fashion. "No seduction," he said to himself. "No love nest, respectable home with parents, no blackmail." Another good set of speculative theories washed out. "And so it was you who made the tea," he said pleasantly.
"Well, I had to. I always do, I mean."
Unhurried, Inspector Neil took her closely through the morning ritual of Mr. Fortescue's tea. The cup and saucer and teapot had already been packed up and dispatched to the appropriate quarter for analysis. Now Inspector Neil learned that Irene Grosvenor, and only Irene Grosvenor, had handled that cup and saucer and teapot. The kettle had been used for making the office tea and had been refilled from the cloakroom tap by Miss Grosvenor.
And the tea itself?
It was Mr. Fortescue's own tea, special China tea. It's kept on the shelf in my room next door.
Inspector Neil nodded. He inquired about sugar, and heard that Mr. Fortescue didn't take sugar. The telephone rang. Inspector Neil picked up the receiver. His face changed a little.
"St. Jude's?"
He nodded to Miss Grosvenor in dismissal.
"That's all for now, thank you, Miss Grosvenor."
Miss Grosvenor sped out of the room hurriedly. Inspector Neil listened carefully to the thin, unemotional tones speaking from St. Jude's Hospital. As the voice spoke, he made a few cryptic signs with a pencil on the corner of the blotter in front of him.
"Died 5 minutes ago, you say?" he asked.
His eye went to the watch on his wrist. 12:43, he wrote on the blotter. The unemotional voice said that Dr. Bernsdorf himself would like to speak to Inspector Neil. Inspector Neil said,
"Right, put him through,"
which rather scandalised the owner of the voice, who had allowed a certain amount of reverence to seep into the official accents. There were then various clicks, buzzes, and far-off ghostly murmurs. Inspector Neil sat patiently waiting. Then, without warning, a deep bass roar caused him to shift the receiver an inch or two away from his ear.
"Hallo, Neil, you old vulture. At it again with your corpses?"
Inspector Neil and Professor Bernsdorf of St. Jude's had been brought together over a case of poisoning just over a year ago and had remained on friendly terms.
"Our man's dead, I hear, Doc."
"Yes, we couldn't do anything by the time he got here."
"And the cause of death?"
"There will have to be an autopsy, naturally." "Very interesting case. Very interesting indeed. Glad I was able to be in on it."
The professional gusto in Bernsdorf's rich tones told Inspector Neil one thing at least.
"I gather you don't think it was natural death," he said dryly.
"Not a dog's chance of it," said Dr. Bernsdorf robustly. "I'm speaking unofficially, of course," he added with belated caution.
Of course, that's understood. He was poisoned?"
"Definitely. And what's more, this is quite unofficial, you understand, just between you and me. I'd be prepared to make a bet on what the poison was."
"Indeed."
"Taxine, my boy. Taxine."
"Taxine? Never heard of it."
"I know. Most unusual. Really delightfully unusual. I don't say I'd have spotted it myself if I hadn't had a case only 3 or 4 weeks ago. Couple of kids playing dolls' tea parties pull berries off a yew tree and use them for tea."
"Is that what it is? Yew berries?"
"Berries or leaves. Highly poisonous. Taxine, of course, is the alkaloid. Don't think I've heard of a case where it was used deliberately. Really most interesting and unusual. You've no idea, Neil, how tired one gets of the inevitable weed killer. Taxine is a real treat. Of course, I may be wrong. Don't quote me, for heaven's sake, but I don't think so. Interesting for you, too, I should think. Where is the routine?"
"A good time is to be had by all, is that the idea? With the exception of the victim?"
"Yes, yes, poor fellow." Dr. Bernsdorf's tone was perfunctory. "Very bad luck on him."
"Did he say anything before he died?"
"Well, one of your fellows was sitting by him with a notebook. He'll have the exact details. He muttered something once about tea, that he had been given something in his tea at the office, but that's nonsense, of course."
"Why is it nonsense?"
Inspector Neil, who had been reviewing speculatively the picture of the glamorous Miss Grosvenor adding yew berries to a brew of tea and finding it incongruous, spoke sharply.
"Because the stuff couldn't possibly have worked so soon. I understand the symptoms came on immediately after he had drunk the tea."
"That's what they say."
"Well, there are very few poisons that act as quickly as that. Apart from the cyanides, of course, and possibly pure nicotine."
"And it definitely wasn't cyanide or nicotine?"
"My dear fellow, he'd have been dead before the ambulance arrived." "Oh, no, there's no question of anything of that kind. I did suspect strychnine, but the convulsions were not at all typical. Still unofficial, of course, but I'll stake my reputation, it's taxine."
"How long would that take to work?"
"Depends. An hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. Deceased looked like a hearty eater. If he'd had a big breakfast, that would slow things up."
"Breakfast?" said Inspector Neil thoughtfully. "Yes, it looks like breakfast?
Breakfast with the Borgias.
Dr. Bernsdorf laughed cheerfully.
Well, good hunting, my lad.
Thanks, Doctor. I'd like to speak to my sergeant before you ring off. Again, there were clicks and buzzes and far-off ghostly voices. And then the sound of heavy breathing came through, an inevitable prelude to Sergeant Hayes' conversation.
Sir, he said urgently. Sir.
Neil here. Did the deceased say anything I ought to know?
Said it was a tea. The tea he had at the office, but the medical officer says not.
Yes, I know about that. Nothing else?
No, sir. But there's one thing that's odd. The suit he was wearing. I checked the contents of the pockets. Usual stuff, handkerchief, keys, change, wallet. But there was one thing that's downright peculiar. The right-hand pocket of his jacket. It had cereal in it.
Cereal?
Yes, sir.
Well, what do you mean by cereal? Do you mean a breakfast food? Farmer's Glory or Wheatifax? Or do you mean corn or barley?
That's right, sir.
Grain it was. Looked like rye to me. Quite a lot of it.
I see.
Odd. But it might have been a sample. Something to do with a business deal.
Quite so, sir, but I thought I'd better mention it.
Quite right, Hay. Inspector Neil sat staring ahead of him for a few moments after he had replaced the telephone receiver. His orderly mind was moving from phase one to phase two of the inquiry, from suspicion of poisoning to certainty of poisoning. Professor Bernsdorf's words may have been unofficial, but Professor Bernsdorf was not a man to be mistaken in his beliefs. Rex Fortescue had been poisoned, and the poison had probably been administered 1 to 3 hours before the onset of the first symptoms. It seemed probable, therefore, that the office staff could be given a clean bill of health. Neil got up and went into the outer office. A little desultory work was being done, but the typewriters were not going at full speed. Miss Griffith, can I have another word with you?
Certainly, Mr. Neil. Could some of the girls go out to lunch? It's long past their regular time. Or would you prefer that we get something sent in?
No, they can go to lunch, but they must return afterwards.
Of course.
Miss Griffith followed Neil back into the private office. She sat down in her composed, efficient way. Without preamble, Inspector Neil said, I have heard from St. Jude's Hospital. Mr. Fortescue died at 12:43. Miss Griffith received the news without surprise, merely shook her head.
I was afraid he was very ill, she said.
She was not, Neil noted, at all distressed. Will you please give me particulars of his home and family?
Certainly. I have already tried to get into communication with Mrs. Fortescue, but it seems she is out playing golf. She was not expected home to lunch. There is some uncertainty as to which course she is playing on, she added in an explanatory manner. They live at Baden Heath, you know, which is a centre for 3 well-known golf courses.
Inspector Neil nodded. Baden Heath was almost entirely inhabited by rich city men. It had an excellent train service, was only 20 miles from London, and was comparatively easy to reach by car, even in the rush of morning and evening traffic. The exact address, please, and the telephone number.
Baden Heath, 3400. The name of the house is Yew Tree Lodge.
What?
The sharp query slipped out before Inspector Neil could control it. Did you say Yew Tree Lodge?
Yes.
Miss Griffith looked faintly curious, but Inspector Neil had himself in hand again.
Can you give me particulars of his family?
Mrs. Fortescue is his second wife. She's much younger than he is. They were married about 2 years ago. The first Mrs. Fortescue has been dead a long time. There are 2 sons and a daughter of the first marriage. The daughter lives at home, and so does the eldest son, who is a partner in the firm. Unfortunately, he is away in the north of England today on business. He is expected to return tomorrow.
When did he go away?
The day before yesterday.
Have you tried to get in touch with him?
Yes. After Mr. Fortescue was removed to the hospital, I rang up the Midland Hotel in Manchester, where I thought he might be staying, but he had left early this morning. I believe he was also going to Sheffield and Leicester, but I'm not sure about that. I can give you the names of certain firms in those cities which he might be visiting.
Certainly an efficient woman, thought the inspector, and if she murdered a man, she would probably murder him very efficiently too. But he forced himself to abandon these speculations and concentrate once more on Mr. Fortescue's home front. There is a second son, you said?
Yes, but owing to a disagreement with his father, he lives abroad.
Are both sons married?
Yes. Mr. Percival has been married for 3 years. He and his wife occupy a self-contained flat in Yew Tree Lodge, though they are moving into their own house at Baden Heath very shortly.
You were not able to get in touch with Mrs. Percival Fortescue when you rang up this morning?
She had gone to London for the day, Miss Griffith went on. Mr. Lancelot got married less than a year ago, to the widow of Lord Frederick Anstice. I expect you've seen pictures of her, in the Tatler, with horses, you know, and at point to points.
Miss Griffith sounded a little breathless, and her cheeks were faintly flushed. Neil, who was quick to catch the moods of human beings, realized that this marriage had thrilled the snob and the romantic in Miss Griffith. The aristocracy was the aristocracy to Miss Griffith. And the fact that the late Lord Frederick Anstice had had a somewhat unsavoury reputation in sporting circles was almost certainly not known to her. Freddy Anstice had blown his brains out just before an inquiry by the stewards into the running of one of his horses. Neil remembered something vaguely about his wife. She had been the daughter of an Irish peer and had been married before to an airman who had been killed in the Battle of Britain. And now, it seemed, she was married to the black sheep of the Fortescue family. For Neil assumed that the disagreement with his father, referred to primly by Miss Griffith, stood for some disgraceful incident in young Lancelot Fortescue's career. Lancelot Fortescue, what a name! And what was the other son? Percival? He wondered what the first Mrs. Fortescue had been like. She'd had a curious taste in Christian names. He drew the phone towards him and dialed T-O-L. He asked for Baden Heath 3400. Presently, a man's voice said,
Baden Heath 3400.
I want to speak to Mrs. Fortescue or Miss Fortescue.
Sorry, they aren't in. Either of them.
The voice struck Inspector Neil as slightly alcoholic. Are you the butler?
That's right.
Mr. Fortescue has been taken seriously ill.
I know. They rung up and said so. But there's nothing I can do about it. Mr. Val's away up north and Mrs. Fortescue's out playing golf. Mrs. Val's gone up to London, but she'll be back for dinner. And Miss Elaine's out with her brownies.
Is there no one in the house I can speak to about Mr. Fortescue's illness? It's important.
Well, I don't know.
The man sounded doubtful.
There's Miss Ramsbottom, but she don't ever speak over the phone. Or there's Miss Dove. She's what you might call the housekeeper.
I'll speak to Miss Dove, please.
I'll try and get hold of her.
His retreating footsteps were audible through the phone. Inspector Neil heard no approaching footsteps, but a minute or two later a woman's voice spoke.
This is Miss Dove speaking.
The voice was low and well poised, with clear-cut enunciation. Inspector Neil formed a favourable picture of Miss Dove. I'm sorry to have to tell you, Miss Dove, that Mr. Fortescue died in St. Jude's Hospital a short time ago. He was taken suddenly ill in his office. I'm anxious to get in touch with his relatives.
Of course. I had no idea.
She broke off. Her voice held no agitation, but it was shocked. She went on.
It is all most unfortunate.
The person you really want to get in touch with is Mr. Percival Fortescue. He would be the one to see to all the necessary arrangements. You might be able to get in touch with him at the Midland in Manchester, or possibly at the Grand in Leicester. Or you might try Shearer and Bonds of Leicester. I don't know their telephone number, I'm afraid, but I know they are a firm on whom he was going to call, and they might be able to inform you where he would be likely to be today. Mrs. Fortescue will certainly be in to dinner, and she may be in to tea. It will be a great shock to her. It must have been very sudden. Mr. Fortescue was quite well when he left here this morning.
You saw him before he left?
Oh, yes. What was it? Heart?
Did he suffer from heart trouble?
No, I don't think so. But I thought, as it was so sudden...
She broke off.
Are you speaking from St. Jude's Hospital? Are you a doctor?
No, Miss Dove, I'm not a doctor. I'm speaking from Mr. Fortescue's office in the city. I am Detective Inspector Neil of the CID, and I shall be coming down to see you as soon as I can get there.
Detective Inspector? Do you mean... What do you mean?
It was a case of sudden death, Miss Dove, and when there is a sudden death, we get called to the scene, especially when the deceased man hasn't seen a doctor lately, which I gather was the case.
It was only the faintest suspicion of a question mark, but the young woman responded. I know. Percival made an appointment twice for him, but he wouldn't keep it. He was quite unreasonable. They've all been worried.
She broke off, and then resumed in her former assured manner.
If Mrs. Fortescue returns to the house before you arrive, what do you want me to tell her?
Practical as they make 'em, thought Inspector Neil. Aloud, he said, just tell her that in a case of sudden death we have to make a few inquiries. Routine inquiries. He hung up. Chapter 3 Neil pushed the telephone away and looked sharply at Miss Griffith. So they've been worried about him lately, he said. Wanted him to see a doctor. You didn't tell me that.
I didn't think of it, said Miss Griffith, and added, he never seemed to me really ill.
Not ill, but what?
Well, just odd, unlike himself, peculiar in his manner.
Worried about something?
Oh, no, not worried. It's we who were worried.
Inspector Neil waited patiently.
It's difficult to say, really, said Miss Griffith. He had moods, you know. Sometimes he was quite boisterous. Once or twice, frankly, I thought he had been drinking. He boasted and told the most extraordinary stories, which I'm sure couldn't possibly have been true. For most of the time I've been here, he was always very close about his affairs, not giving anything away, you know. But lately he's been quite different, expansive and positively, well, flinging money about. Most unlike his usual manner. Why, when the office boy had to go to his grandmother's funeral, Mr. Fortescue called him in and gave him a £5 note and told him to put it on the second favourite, and then roared with laughter. He wasn't... Well, he just wasn't like himself, that's all I can say.
As though perhaps he had something on his mind.
Not in the usual meaning of the term. It was as though he were looking forward to something pleasurable, exciting.
Possibly a big deal that he was going to pull off.
Miss Griffith agreed with more conviction. Yes, that's much more what I mean. As though everyday things didn't matter any more. He was excited, and some very odd-looking people came to see him on business. People who'd never been here before. It worried Mr. Percival dreadfully.
Oh, it worried him, did it?
Yes. Mr. Percival's always been very much in his father's confidence, you see. His father relied on him. But lately...
Lately they weren't getting along so well?
Well, Mr. Fortescue was doing a lot of things that Mr. Percival thought unwise. Mr. Percival is always very careful and prudent. But suddenly his father didn't listen to him any more, and Mr. Percival was very upset.
And they had a real row about it all?
Inspector Neil was still probing.
I don't know about a row. Of course, I realise now Mr. Fortescue can't have been himself shouting like that.
Shouted, did he? What did he say?
He came right out in the typist's room.
So that you all heard?
Well, yes.
And he called Percival names, abused him, swore at him? What did he say Percival had done?
It was more that he hadn't done anything. He called him a miserable, pettifogging little clerk. He said he had no large outlook, no conception of doing business in a big way. He said, I shall get Lance home again. He's worth 10 of you, and he's married well. Lance has got guts, even if he did risk a criminal prosecution once. Oh, dear, I oughtn't to have said that.
Miss Griffith, carried away as others before her had been under Inspector Neil's expert handling, was suddenly overcome with confusion.
Don't worry, said Inspector Neil comfortingly. What's past is past.
Oh, yes, it was a long time ago. Mr. Lance was just young and high-spirited and didn't really realise what he was doing.
Inspector Neil had heard that view before and didn't agree with it, but he passed on to fresh questions.
Tell me a little more about the staff here.
Miss Griffith, hurrying to get away from her indiscretion, poured out information about the various personalities in the firm. Inspector Neil thanked her and then said he would like to see Miss Grosvenor again. Detective Constable Waite sharpened his pencil. He remarked wistfully that this was a ritzy joint. His glance wandered appreciatively over the huge chairs, the big desk and the indirect lighting.
All these people have got ritzy names, too, he said. Grosvenor, that's something to do with a duke. And Fortescue, that's a classy name, too.
Inspector Neil smiled.
His father's name wasn't Fortescue. Fontescue, and he came from somewhere in Central Europe. I suppose this man thought Fortescue sounded better.
Detective Constable Waite looked at his superior officer with awe.
So you know all about him? I just looked up a few things before coming along on the call.
Not got a record, had he?
Oh, no. Mr. Fortescue was much too clever for that. He had certain connections with the black market and put through one or two deals that are questionable, to say the least of it, but they've always been just within the law.
I see, said Waite.
Not a nice man.
A twister, said Neil.
But we've got nothing on him.
The Inland Revenue have been after him for a long time, but he's been too clever for them. Quite a financial genius, the late Mr. Fortescue.
The sort of man, said Constable Waite, who might have enemies?
He spoke hopefully.
Oh, yes, certainly enemies. But he was poisoned at home, remember, or so it would seem.
You know, Waite, I see a kind of pattern emerging. An old-fashioned, familiar kind of pattern. The good boy Percival, the bad boy Lance, attractive to women, the wife who's younger than her husband and who's vague about which course she's going to play golf on. It's all very, very familiar. But there's one thing that sticks out in a most incongruous way.
Constable Waite asked, "What's that?" Just as the door opened and Miss Grosvenor, her poise restored and once more her glamorous self, inquired haughtily,
"You wish to see me?"
"I wanted to ask you a few questions about your employer. Your late employer, perhaps I should say."
"Poor soul," said Miss Grosvenor unconvincingly.
"I want to know if you've noticed any difference in him lately."
"Well, yes, I did, as a matter of fact."
"In what way?"
"I couldn't really say. He seemed to talk a lot of nonsense. I couldn't really believe half of what he said. And then he lost his temper very easily, especially with Mr. Percival. Not with me, because, of course, I never argue. I just say, 'Yes, Mr. Fortescue,' whatever peculiar thing he says. Said, I mean."
Did he ever, well, make any passes at you?
Miss Grosvenor replied rather regretfully.
Well, no, I couldn't exactly say that.
There's just one other thing, Miss Grosvenor. Was Mr. Fortescue in the habit of carrying grain about in his pocket? Miss Grosvenor displayed a lively surprise.
Grain in his pocket? Do you mean to feed pigeons or something?
It could have been for that purpose.
Oh, I'm sure he didn't. Mr. Fortescue feed pigeons? Oh, no.
Could he have had barley or rye in his pocket today for any special reason? A sample, perhaps? Some deal in grain?
Oh, no. He was expecting the Asiatic oil people this afternoon, and the president of the Atticus Building Society. No one else.
Oh, well.
Neil dismissed the subject and Miss Grosvenor with a wave of the hand.
Lovely legs she's got, said Constable Waite with a sigh, and super nylons.
Legs are no help to me, said Inspector Neil. I'm left with what I had before, a pocket full of rye and no explanation of it.
Chapter 4 Mary Dove paused on her way downstairs and looked out through the big window on the stairs. A car had just driven up, from which two men were alighting. The taller of the two stood for a moment with his back to the house, surveying his surroundings. Mary Dove appraised the two men thoughtfully. Inspector Neil and, presumably, a subordinate. She turned from the window and looked at herself in the full-length mirror that hung on the wall where the staircase turned. She saw a small, demure figure with immaculate white collar and cuffs on a beige-grey dress. Her dark hair was parted in the middle and drawn back in two shining waves to a knot in the back of her neck. The lipstick she used was a pale rose colour. On the whole, Mary Dove was satisfied with her appearance. A very faint smile on her lips, she went on down the stairs. Inspector Neil, surveying the house, was saying to himself, "Call it a lodge, indeed. Yew Tree Lodge. The affectation of these rich people." The house was what he, Inspector Neil, would call a mansion. He knew what a lodge was. He'd been brought up in one. The lodge at the gates of Hartington Park, that vast, unwieldy Palladian house with its 29 bedrooms, which had now been taken over by the National Trust. The lodge had been small and attractive from the outside, and had been damp, uncomfortable, and devoid of anything but the most primitive form of sanitation within. Fortunately, these facts had been accepted as quite proper and fitting by Inspector Neil's parents. They had no rent to pay, and nothing whatever to do except open and shut the gates when required. And there were always plenty of rabbits and an occasional pheasant or so for the pot. Mrs. Neil had never discovered the pleasures of electric irons, slow combustion stoves, airing cupboards, hot and cold water from taps, and the switching on of light by a mere flick of a finger. In winter the Neils had an oil lamp, and in summer they went to bed when it got dark. They were a healthy family and a happy one, all thoroughly behind the times. So when Inspector Neil heard the word lodge, it was his childhood memories that stirred. But this place, this pretentiously named Yew Tree Lodge, was just the kind of mansion that rich people built themselves and then called it their little place in the country. It wasn't in the country either, according to Inspector Neil's idea of the country. The house was a large, solid, red brick structure, sprawling lengthwise rather than upward, with rather too many gables and a vast number of leaded paned windows. The gardens were highly artificial, all laid out in rose beds and pergolas and pools, and living up to the name of the house with large numbers of clipped yew hedges. Plenty of yew here for anybody with a desire to obtain the raw material of taxine. Over on the right, behind the rose pergola, There was a bit of actual nature left, a vast yew tree, of the kind one associates with churchyards, its branches held up by stakes, like a kind of Moses of the forest world. That tree, the inspector thought, had been there long before the rash of newly built red brick houses had begun to spread over the countryside. It had been there before the golf courses had been laid out, and the fashionable architects had walked round with their rich clients, pointing out the advantages of the various sites. And since it was a valuable antique, the tree had been kept and incorporated in the new set-up, and had, perhaps, given its name to the new desirable residence, Yew Tree Lodge, and possibly the berries from that very tree. Inspector Neil cut off these unprofitable speculations. Must get on with the job. He rang the bell. It was opened promptly by a middle-aged man who fitted in quite accurately with the mental image Inspector Neil had formed of him over the phone. A man with a rather spurious air of smartness, a shifty eye, and a rather unsteady hand. Inspector Neil announced himself and his subordinate, and had the pleasure of seeing an instant look of alarm come into the butler's eye. Neil did not attach too much importance to that. It might easily have nothing to do with the death of Rex Fortescue. It was, quite possibly, a purely automatic reaction.
"Has Mrs. Fortescue returned yet?"
"No, sir."
"Nor Mr. Percival Fortescue? Nor Miss Fortescue?"
"No, sir."
"Then I would like to see Miss Dove, please." The man turned his head slightly.
"Here's Miss Dove now, coming downstairs."
Inspector Neil took in Miss Dove as she came composedly down the wide staircase. This time, the mental picture did not correspond with the reality. Unconsciously, the word housekeeper had conjured up a vague impression of someone large and authoritative, dressed in black, with somewhere concealed about her a jingle of keys. The inspector was quite unprepared for the small, trim figure descending towards him. The soft, dove-coloured tones of her dress, the white collar and cuffs, the neat waves of hair, the faint Mona Lisa smile. It all seemed somehow just a little unreal, as though this young woman of under 30 was playing a part. Not, he thought, the part of a housekeeper, but the part of Mary Dove. Her appearance was directed towards living up to her name. She greeted him composedly.
"Inspector Neil?"
"Yes, this is Sergeant Hay. Mr. Fortescue, as I told you through the phone, died in St. Jude's Hospital at 12:43. It seems likely that his death was the result of something he ate at breakfast this morning. I should be glad, therefore, if Sergeant Hay could be taken to the kitchen, where he can make inquiries as to the food served."
Her eyes met his for a moment, thoughtfully. Then she nodded.
"Of course," she said.
She turned to the uneasily hovering butler. "Crump, will you take Sergeant Hay out and show him whatever he wants to see?" The two men departed together. Mary Dove said to Neil, "Will you come in here?"
She opened the door of a room and preceded him into it. It was a characterless apartment, clearly labelled smoking room, with panelling, rich upholstery, large stuffed chairs, and a suitable set of sporting prints on the walls.
"Please sit down."
He sat, and Mary Dove sat opposite him. She chose, he noticed, to face the light, an unusual preference for a woman. Still more unusual if a woman had anything to hide. But perhaps Mary Dove had nothing to hide.
"It is very unfortunate," she said, "that none of the family is available. Mrs. Fortescue may return at any minute, and so may Mrs. Val. I have sent wires to Mr. Percival Fortescue at various places."
"Thank you, Miss Dove."
"You say that Mr. Fortescue's death was caused by something he may have eaten for breakfast? Food poisoning, you mean?"
"Possibly." He watched her.
She said composedly, "It seems unlikely.
For breakfast this morning, there were bacon and scrambled eggs, coffee, toast and marmalade. There was also a cold ham on the sideboard, but that had been cut yesterday, and no one felt any ill effects. No fish of any kind was served. No sausages, nothing like that.
I see you know exactly what was served.
Naturally, I order the meals. For dinner last night...
No, Inspector Neil interrupted her. It would not be a question of dinner last night.
I thought the onset of food poisoning could sometimes be delayed as much as 24 hours.
Not in this case.
Will you tell me exactly what Mr. Fortescue ate and drank before leaving the house this morning? He had early tea brought to his room at 8 o'clock. Breakfast was at 9:15. Mr. Fortescue, as I have told you, had scrambled eggs, bacon, coffee, toast and marmalade.
Any cereal?
No, he doesn't like cereals.
The sugar for the coffee, is it lump sugar or granulated?
Lump, but Mr. Fortescue does not take sugar in his coffee.
Is he in the habit of taking any medicines in the morning? Salts, a tonic, some digestive remedy?
No, nothing of that kind.
Did you have breakfast with him also?
No, I do not take meals with the family.
Who was at breakfast?
Mrs. Fortescue, Miss Fortescue, Mrs. Val Fortescue, Mr. Percival Fortescue, of course, was away.
And Mrs. and Miss Fortescue ate the same things for breakfast.
Mrs. Fortescue has only coffee, orange juice and toast. Mrs. Val and Miss Fortescue always eat a hearty breakfast. Besides eating scrambled eggs and cold ham, they would probably have a cereal as well. Mrs. Val drinks tea, not coffee.
Inspector Neil reflected for a moment. The opportunities seemed at least to be narrowing down. Three people, and three people only, had had breakfast with the deceased. His wife, his daughter, and his daughter-in-law. Either of them might have seized an opportunity to add taxine to his cup of coffee. The bitterness of the coffee would have masked the bitter taste of the taxine. There was the early morning tea, of course, but Bernsdorf had intimated that the taste would be noticeable in tea. But perhaps first thing in the morning, before the senses were alert.
He looked up to find Mary Dove watching him.
Your questions about tonic and medicines seem to me rather odd, Inspector, she said. It seems to imply that either there was something wrong with the medicine or that something had been added to it. Surely neither of those processes could be described as food poisoning.
Neil eyed her steadily. I did not say definitely that Mr. Fortescue died of food poisoning, but some kind of poisoning. In fact, just poisoning.
She repeated softly. Poisoning. She appeared neither startled nor dismayed, merely interested. Her attitude was of one sampling a new experience.
In fact, she said as much, remarking after a moment's reflection,
I have never had anything to do with a poisoning case before.
It's not very pleasant, Neil informed her dryly.
No, I suppose not.
She thought about it for a moment, and then looked up at him with a sudden smile.
I didn't do it, she said. But I suppose everybody will tell you that.
Have you any idea who did do it, Miss Dove? She shrugged her shoulders.
Frankly, he was an odious man. Anybody might have done it.
But people aren't poisoned just for being odious, Miss Dove. There usually has to be a pretty solid motive.
Yes, of course.
She was thoughtful. Do you care to tell me something about the household here? She looked up at him. He was a little startled to find her eyes cool and amused.
This isn't exactly a statement you're asking me to make, is it? No, it couldn't be, because your sergeant is busy upsetting the domestic staff. I shouldn't like to have what I say read out in court, but all the same, I should rather like to see it
unofficially. Off the record, so to speak. Go ahead then, Miss Dove. I've no witness, as you've already observed.
She leaned back, swinging one slim foot and narrowing her eyes.
Let me start by saying that I've no feeling of loyalty to my employers. I work for them because it's a job that pays well, and I insist that it should pay well.
I was a little surprised to find you doing this type of job. It struck me that with your brains and education,
I ought to be confined in an office or compiling files in a ministry. My dear Inspector Neil, this is the perfect racket. People will pay anything, anything to be spared domestic worries. To find and engage a staff is a thoroughly tedious job. Writing to agencies, putting in advertisements, interviewing people, making arrangements for interviews, and finally keeping the whole thing running smoothly. It takes a certain capacity which most of these people haven't got.
And suppose your staff, when you've assembled it, runs out on you. I've heard of such things.
Mary smiled. If necessary, I can make the beds, dust the rooms, cook a meal and serve it without anyone noticing the difference. Of course, I don't advertise that fact. It might give rise to ideas, but I can always be sure of tidying over any little gap. But there aren't often gaps. I work only for the extremely rich, who will pay anything to be comfortable. I pay top prices, and so I get the best of what's going.
Such as the butler?
She threw him an amused, appreciative glance. There's always that trouble with a couple. Crump stays because of Mrs. Crump, who is one of the best cooks I've ever come across. She's a jewel, and one would put up with a good deal to keep her. Our Mr. Fortescue likes his food. Liked, I should say. In this household, nobody has any scruples, and they have plenty of money. Butter, eggs, cream. Mrs. Crump can command what she likes. As for Crump, he just makes the grade. His silver's all right, and his waiting at table is not too bad. I keep the key of the wine cellar, and a sharp eye on the whisky and gin, and supervise his valeting.
Inspector Neil raised his eyebrows. The admirable Miss Crichton.
I find one must know how to do everything oneself. Then one need never do it. But you wanted to know my impression of the family.
If you don't mind.
They are really all quite odious. The late Mr. Fortescue was the kind of crook who is always careful to play safe. He boasted a great deal of his various smart dealings. He was rude and overbearing in manner, and was a definite bully. Mrs. Fortescue, Adele, is his second wife, and about 30 years younger than he is. He came across her at Brighton. She was a manicurist on the lookout for big money. She's very good-looking, a real sexy piece, if you know what I mean.
Inspector Neil was shocked, but managed not to show it. A girl like Mary Dove would not to say such things, he felt. The young lady was continuing composedly.
Adele married him for his money, of course, and his son Percival and his daughter Elaine were simply livid about it. They're as nasty as they can be to her, but very wisely she doesn't care or even notice. She knows she's got the old man where she wants him. Oh, dear, the wrong tense again. I haven't really grasped yet that he's dead.
Let's hear about the son.
Dear Percival. Val, as his wife calls him. Percival is a mealy-mouthed hypocrite. He's prim and sly and cunning. He's terrified of his father and has always let himself be bullied. But he's quite clever at getting his own way. Unlike his father, he's mean about money. Economy is one of his passions, and that's why he's been so long about finding a house of his own. Having a suite of rooms here saved his pocket.
And his wife?
Jennifer's meek and seems very stupid, but I'm not so sure. She was a hospital nurse before her marriage. Nursed Percival through pneumonia to a romantic conclusion. The old man was disappointed by the marriage. He's a snob and wanted Percival to make what he called a good marriage. He despises poor Mrs. Vale and snubs her. She disliked him a good deal, I think. Her principal interests are shopping and the cinema. Her principal grievance is that her husband keeps her short of money.
What about the daughter?
Elaine, I'm rather sorry for Elaine. She's not a bad sort. One of those great schoolgirls who never grow up. She plays games quite well and runs girl guides and brownies and all that sort of thing. There was some sort of affair not long ago with a disgruntled young schoolmaster, but father discovered the young man had communistic ideas and came down on the romance like a ton of bricks.
She hadn't got the spirit to stand up to him.
Well, she had. It was the young man who ratted. A question of money yet again, I fancy. Elaine is not particularly attractive, poor dear.
And the other son?
I've never seen him. He's attractive by all accounts, and a thoroughly bad lot. Some little matter of a forged cheque in the past. He lives in East Africa.
And is estranged from his father?
Yes. Mr. Fortescue couldn't cut him off with a shilling because he'd already made him a junior partner in the firm. But he's held no communication with him for years. And in fact, if Lance was ever mentioned, he used to say, "Don't talk to me of that rascal. He's no son of mine." All the same...
Yes, Miss Dove?
Mary said slowly, "All the same... I shouldn't be surprised if old Fortescue hadn't been planning to get him back here."
"What makes you think that?"
"Because about a month ago, old Fortescue had a terrific row with Percival. He found out something that Percival had been doing behind his back. I don't know what it was, and he was absolutely furious. Percival suddenly stopped being the white-headed boy. He's been quite different lately, too."
"Mr. Fortescue was quite different."
"No, I meant Percival. He's gone about looking worried to death."
"Now, what about servants? You've already described the Crumps. Who else is there?"
"Gladys Martin is the parlourmaid, or waitress, as they like to call themselves nowadays. She does the downstairs rooms, lays the table, clears away and helps Crump wait at table. Quite a decent sort of girl, but very nearly half-witted. The adenoidal type."
Neil nodded.
"The housemaid is Ellen Curtis. Elderly, very crabbed and very cross, but has been in good service and is a first-class housemaid. The rest is outside help, odd women who come in."
"And those are the only people living here?"
"There's old Miss Ramsbottom."
"Who is she?"
"Mr. Fortescue's sister-in-law, his first wife's sister. His wife was a good deal older than he was, and her sister again is a good deal older than she, which makes her well over 70. She has a room of her own on the second floor, does her own cooking and all that, with just a woman coming in to clean. She's rather eccentric, and she never liked her brother-in-law. But she came here while her sister was alive and stayed on when she died. Mr. Fortescue never bothered about her much. She's quite a character, though, is Aunt Effie."
"And that is all?"
"That's all."
"So we come to you, Miss Dove."
"You want particulars? I'm an orphan. I took a secretarial course at the St. Alfred's Secretarial College. I took a job as a shorthand typist, left it and took another. Decided I was in the wrong racket and started on my present career. I have been with 3 different employers. After about a year or 18 months, I get tired of a particular place and move on. I have been at Yew Tree Lodge just over a year. I will type out the names and addresses of my various employers and give them, with a copy of my references, to Sergeant Hay, is it? Will that be satisfactory?"
"Perfectly, Miss Dove."
Neil was silent for a moment, enjoying a mental image of Miss Dove tampering with Mr. Fortescue's breakfast. His mind went back further, and he saw her methodically gathering yew berries in a little basket. With a sigh, he returned to the present and reality.
"Now I would like to see the girl, Gladys, and then the housemaid, Ellen."
he added as he rose, "By the way, Miss Dove, can you give me any idea why Mr. Fortescue would be carrying loose grain in his pocket?"
"Grain?"
She stared at him with what appeared to be genuine surprise.
"Yes, grain. Does that suggest something to you, Miss Dove?"
"Nothing at all.
Who looked after his clothes?"
"Crump."
"I see. Did Mr. Fortescue and Mrs. Fortescue occupy the same bedroom?"
"Yes. He had a dressing room and bath, of course, and so did she."
Mary glanced down at her wristwatch.
"I really think that she ought to be back very soon now."
The inspector had risen. He said, in a pleasant voice,
"Do you know one thing, Miss Dove? It strikes me as very odd that even though there are three golf courses in the immediate neighbourhood, it has yet not been possible to find Mrs. Fortescue on one of them before now."
"It would not be so odd, Inspector, if she did not actually happen to be playing golf at all."
Mary's voice was dry. The inspector said sharply,
"I was distinctly informed that she was playing golf."
"She took her golf clubs and announced her intention of doing so. She was driving her own car, of course."
He looked at her steadily, perceiving the inference.
"Whom was she playing with, do you know?"
"I think it possible that it might be Mr. Vivian Dubois."
Neil contented himself by saying, "I see."
"I'll send Gladys in to you. She'll probably be scared to death."
Mary paused for a moment by the door. Then she said,
"I should hardly advise you to go too much by all I've told you. I'm a malicious creature."
She went out. Inspector Neil looked at the closed door and wondered. Whether actuated by malice or not, what she had told him could not fail to be suggestive. If Rex Fortescue had been deliberately poisoned, and it seemed almost certain that that was the case, then the set-up at Yew Tree Lodge seemed highly promising. Motives appeared to be lying thick on the ground. Chapter 5. The girl who entered the room with obvious unwillingness was an unattractive, frightened-looking girl who managed to look sluttish in spite of being tall and smartly dressed in a claret-coloured uniform. She said at once, fixing imploring eyes upon him,
"I didn't do anything. I didn't really. I don't know anything about it."
"That's all right," said Neil heartily.
His voice had changed slightly. It sounded more cheerful and a good deal commoner in intonation. He wanted to put the frightened rabbit Gladys at her ease.
"Sit down here," he went on. "I just want to know about breakfast this morning."
"I didn't do anything at all."
"Well, you laid the breakfast, didn't you?"
"Yes, I did that."
Even that admission came unwillingly. She looked both guilty and terrified. But Inspector Neil was used to witnesses who looked like that. He went on cheerfully, trying to put her at her ease, asking questions, who had come down first and who next. Elaine Fortescue had been the first down to breakfast. She'd come in just as Crump was bringing in the coffee pot. Mrs. Fortescue was down next, and then Mrs. Val and the master last. They waited on themselves. The tea and coffee and the hot dishes were all on hot plates on the sideboard. He learnt little of importance from her that he did not know already. The food and drink were as Mary Dove had described them. The master and Mrs. Fortescue and Miss Elaine took coffee and Mrs. Val took tea. Everything had been quite as usual. Neil questioned her about herself, and here she answered more readily. She'd been in the NAFI, a sort of USO called Navy, Army and Air Forces Institute, and after that, in a cafe at Eastbourne. Then she thought she'd like to try private service, and had come to Yew Tree Lodge last September. She'd been there 2 months.
"And you like it?"
"Well, it's all right, I suppose."
She added,
It's not so hard on your feet, but you don't get so much freedom.
Tell me about Mr. Fortescue's clothes, his suits. Who looked after them, brushed them and all that?
Gladys looked faintly resentful.
Mr. Crump's supposed to, but half the time he makes me do it.
Who brushed and pressed the suit Mr. Fortescue had on today?
I don't remember which one he wore. He's got ever so many.
Have you ever found grain in the pocket of one of his suits?
Grain?
She looked puzzled.
Rye, to be exact.
Rye? That's bread, isn't it? A sort of black bread. Got a nasty taste, I always think.
That's bread made from rye. Rye is the grain itself. There was some found in the pocket of your master's coat.
In his coat pocket?
Yes. Do you know how it got there?
Couldn't say, I'm sure. I never saw any.
He could get no more from her. For a moment or two, he wondered if she knew more about the matter than she was willing to admit. She certainly seemed embarrassed and on the defensive, but on the whole he put it down to a natural fear of the police. When he finally dismissed her, she asked,
"It's really true, is it? He's dead?"
"Yes, he's dead."
"Very sudden, wasn't it? They said when they rang up from the office that he'd had a kind of fit."
"Yes, it was a kind of fit."
Gladys said,
"A girl I used to know had fits. Come on any time they did. Used to scare me."
For the moment, this reminiscence seemed to overcome her suspicions. Inspector Neil made his way to the kitchen. His reception was immediate and alarming. A woman of vast proportions, with a red face and armed with a rolling pin, stepped towards him in a menacing fashion.
"Police, indeed," she said. "Coming here and saying my cooking's poisoned the muster. Nothing of the kind, I'll have you know. Anything I've sent into the dining room has been just what it should be. Coming here and saying I poisoned the muster, I'll have the law on you, police or no police. No bad food's ever been served in this house."
It was some time before Inspector Neil could appease the irate artist. Sergeant Hay looked in, grinning, from the pantry, and Inspector Neil gathered that he had already run the gauntlet of Mrs. Crump's wrath. The scene was terminated by the ringing of the telephone. Neil went out into the hall to find Mary Dove taking the call. She was writing down a message on a pad. Turning her head over her shoulder, she said,
"It's a telegram."
The call concluded, she replaced the receiver and handed the pad on which she had been writing to the inspector. The place of origin was Paris, and the message ran as follows. "Fortescue, Yew Tree Lodge, Baden Heath, Surrey. Sorry your letter delayed. We'll be with you tomorrow about tea time. Shall expect roast veal for dinner. Lance." Inspector Neil raised his eyebrows. "So, the prodigal son had been summoned home," he said. Chapter 6. At the moment when Rex Fortescue had been drinking his last cup of tea, Lance Fortescue and his wife had been sitting under the trees on the Champs-Élysées, watching the people walking past.
"It's all very well to say, 'describe him, Pat. I'm a rotten hand at descriptions. What do you want to know? The governor's a bit of an old crook, you know. But you won't mind that. You must be used to that, more or less."
"Oh, yes," said Pat. "Yes, as you say, I'm acclimatized."
She tried to keep a certain forlornness out of her voice.
Perhaps, she reflected, the whole world was really crooked. Or was it just that she herself had been unfortunate? She was a tall, long-legged girl, not beautiful, but with a charm that was made up of vitality and a warm-hearted personality. She moved well and had lovely, gleaming, chestnut-brown hair. Perhaps from a long association with horses, she had acquired the look of a thoroughbred filly. Crookedness in the racing world she knew about.
Now, it seemed, she was to encounter crookedness in the financial world. Though, for all that, it seemed that her father-in-law, whom she had not yet met, was, as far as the law was concerned, a pillar of rectitude. All these people who went about boasting of smart work were the same. Technically, they always managed to be within the law. Yet it seemed to her that her Lance, whom she loved, and who had, admittedly, strayed outside the ringed fence in earlier days, had an honesty that these successful practitioners of the crooked lacked.
"I don't mean," said Lance, "that he's a swindler, not anything like that, but he knows how to put over a fast one."
"Sometimes," said Pat, "I feel I hate people who put over fast ones." She added, "You're fond of him." It was a statement, not a question. Lance considered it for a moment, and then said in a surprised kind of voice, "Do you know, darling, I believe I am." Pat laughed. He turned his head to look at her. His eyes narrowed. What a darling she was. He loved her. The whole thing was worth it for her sake.
"In a way, you know," he said, "it's hell going back. City life. Home on the 518. It's not my kind of life. I'm far more at home among the down-and-outs. But one's got to settle down sometime, I suppose. And with you to hold my hand, the process may even be quite a pleasant one. And since the old boy has come round, one ought to take advantage of it. I must say I was surprised when I got his letter. Percival, of all people, blotting his copybook. Percival, the good little boy. Mind you, Percy was always sly. Yes, he was always sly."
"I don't think," said Patricia Fortescue, "that I'm going to like your brother Percival."
"Well, don't let me put you against him. Percy and I never got on. That's all there is to it. I blew my pocket money, he saved his. I had disreputable but entertaining friends. Percy made what's called worthwhile contacts. Poles apart we were, he and I. I always thought him a poor fish, and he... sometimes, you know, I think he almost hated me. I don't know why, exactly."
"I think I can see why."
"Can you, darling? You're so brainy.